Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Candy. Thank you so much for joining us today. Billions and billions of federal dollars, hundreds of different policies, all rest in the U.S. Farm Bill. With very little bipartisanship in Washington these days, it's not too surprising it's taken so long for Congress to make some kind of a deal on the legislation. But time is running out. On today's show, why the 2013 Farm Bill just can't quite get done and what it means for Michigan and the U.S. economy. And then we take a temperature check. Just how do local officials think the state legislature is doing? Here's a little spoiler alert. Not too well. But first, there has been an apology from Detroit's emergency manager for those now infamous comments that were made in an interview with the Wall Street Journal. That's where Kevin Orr described Detroit in these words, and I quote, "For a long time, the city was dumb, lazy, happy, and rich." But now, speaking with WXYZ TV anchors and reporters, Orr offered up a mea culpa.
In my wildest dreams, I never would have thought that would have been interpreted as an insult. I also perhaps was not as in tune as I should have been to the fact that I said that the week before an election. Not particularly a smart thing to do. I was being dumb in that sense.
What effect will those words in the apology have on Orr's ability to work with Detroit leaders and citizens? And was there a point to what he was trying to say to the Wall Street Journal? Well, we're joined for that conversation by Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Good to have you on the program as always, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, were you surprised and what was your reaction to the dumb, lazy, happy and rich comment?
Well, I was out of town on vacation when it broke, and I did read it and read the piece in the journal, and I think I took it differently than a lot of Detroiters did. And I think you have to subdivide this into two pieces. One is whether Kevin Orr likes to admit it or not, whatever he says publicly has political implications. And I think he's starting to – he's getting that baptism by fire and recognizing – sometimes after the fact that there are certain things he probably shouldn't say. But there are a lot of politicians that have to go through that process, and it is a learning process.
There is quite a curve, isn't there?
Yes, there is, particularly in this environment, particularly when he was someone who was not elected, he was appointed, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not at all surprised that people were up in arms about this. Having said that, I think if you look at the history of Detroit and where it was to where it is today, a lot of that's very defensible. He said, use the word dumb. They have an illiteracy rate in the city of Detroit of 49%. The graduation rate in the high schools is abysmal. That is not a secret. None of that is a secret. Rich. At one time, Detroit led the country in per capita income, and so did Michigan. It doesn't anymore. So you can go down. I mean, happy is a state of mind. I can't get to that.
Yeah, and you think about it, I don't know how happy Detroit has been since the 67 riots, honestly.
Well, I think as things have deteriorated, increasing numbers of Detroiters are not happy. And the best evidence of that, Cynthia, is that it's lost a third of its population in the last 10 years. I think we've talked about this before. I don't think you would find another city anywhere in the industrialized world that has lost a third of its population, except for something like a Katrina-ravaged New Orleans in that time frame. And these are people that just said, we're out of here. What does that tell you? Does that signify that they were happy? I don't think so.
Can I ask about the lazy? We didn't touch on that. What do you think that was about?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's probably more subjective, although I think if you started to – if you talk to employers in the city of Detroit about absentee rates, for example, which they don't like to talk about because their union workforces don't like it to be shared, that's been a real problem. I know it's been a problem in the auto industry and in plants not only in Southeast Michigan but around the country, but particularly in Southeast Michigan. Now, they've gotten their arms around it certainly in the last 10-plus years with the help of the UAW. But absenteeism has been a problem as well.
But that is not just Detroiters. That's plants in the suburbs and around the nation.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that's more of a subjective thing. But I don't think there's any question. Mm-hmm. But what one of the things that has brought both Detroit and the auto industry to their twin reckonings has been the fact that the past was a lot better than the present. And the auto, in the case of the autos, they, you know, they controlled a lot bigger chunk of the market. There was a lot less competition. And then when they finally had to contend with it, they didn't contend with it very well. So it really has been a steady slide of these, both the city and this industry. And the industry has now come back out of it, and now the city is in the process of trying to come back out of it. But it has been there are many many markers of decline.
Daniel, if, as you say, there's truth in Kevin Orr's words, if there's an essence of truth, why do you think there was such an explosion of public reaction from leaders and Detroiters who were offended by this?
Well, look, pull the lens back a little bit here to answer the question. There's a long history in Detroit of people here getting bent out of shape about things that outsiders say about their city or about their auto industry or about you name it. I mean, it goes on all the time. I mean, this is nothing new. And the fact that people would be offended by this doesn't surprise me. That doesn't mean that there isn't one or several grains of truth in what he's saying as well. I think we would all agree that it was probably impolitic. You know, one of my personal rules, in my family we call it Howe's Rule 104, is thou shalt not give thine enemies a club to beat me with. And that's what he did. I mean, he gave his critics a club to beat him with, and they did.
Yeah.
And you've got to be a little more astute about what you say publicly and how you say it and to whom you say it, because this is a very sensitive time for people. I think people, the fact that you don't have a lot of the street protests and demonstrations and everything that a lot of people predicted with the imposition of an emergency manager signifies to me that a lot of people are A, weary, and B, know that things got to change, and C, want things to change. So that being the case, is there any percentage in rubbing people's face in it? I think the answer to that is probably no.
It sounded to me like something that you'd hear maybe one lawyer say to another while they're having dinner after a case or something, not for the whole world to read.
Or you would get some New York investor or bondholder who would come in and comment about Detroit, and you hear that all the time as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That wouldn't surprise me. But, you know, it's one thing for someone who is, you know, like that outside to pass judgment on Detroit. I find that wearying, frankly. It's another thing for someone in a position of authority to do this. But, you know, I was reminded of Alan Mulally at Ford when I heard this. And Alan Mulally, when he first came to Ford in 2006, one of his favorite things to tell people was, you realize this company's been going out of business for 25 years.
Hmm.
I mean, he would change the number. Sometimes he'd say 30 years. Sometimes he'd say 20 years. But essentially what he was saying was, you people here have screwed this thing up so bad for so long that this is in the situation we find ourselves in was inevitable. Now, he's not calling them dumb. He's not using that word, but he's certainly implying it. And the point is that people that are in leadership positions who come in from the outside to very difficult situations, I think oftentimes look at things like that.
Fresh now, eyes.
Right. And he would try to be less accusatory.
Mm.
But he would still be sending the message that, listen, the way you guys have been doing things here has led to this. And that's why I'm here. And that is why he was there. I mean, the same thing at General Motors. You know, you talked to Dan, last time I interviewed Dan Ackerson, he said, you know, he reminded me, he said, this company went bankrupt. He called it a nose plant. He said that was quite a nose plant. I mean, mm-hmm. You can't get away from the fact of what has happened to these companies and what has led to their rebirth. And it's difficult. And it's difficult for people to stomach. But, you know, what I saw is that auto industry was downward spiraling, where fewer and fewer people who were being the homers and just saying, you know, my company, right or wrong. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people recognized that the situation was very, very serious, including, I might add, the UAW. I mean, those guys had no illusions about how serious the situation was.
The apology that was Kevin Orr offered in speaking mm-hmm. at WXYZ TV, was it too late? Was it the right thing? Was it not enough?
Well, you know, I would say it may have been a little late, but I think he probably wanted to do it in a venue that it would get wide distribution.
Mm.
And that's a good way to do it at a television station, where they've got cameras rolling, and the apology can be essentially unedited.
Sure.
And, you know, they can lay it out there and do it. I mean, you could argue it's a little bit late. Whatever you think of the truth or the grains of truth in what he said, I think he had to do it. I don't think he had much of a choice, because he had to try and take the issue off the table. Now, people who do not support him and do not support the idea of an emergency manager are not going to be mollified, and it's just going to be one more reason why they don't like the guy or the concept. But, you know, the fact that he said it and the fact that he apologized or didn't apologize doesn't change the challenge that the city faces. And I think that's really – I mean, let's keep our eyes on the prize here, folks. What really needs to – what is before them is a very difficult restructuring challenge. And this is kind of a rhetorical thing that probably creates some noise. And I don't think he's going to totally mute it by apologizing, but essentially what he's doing is saying, I got to move on here, and we all need to move on.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, who joins us each Thursday. Thanks so much for your time, Daniel.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
We'd love to get your thoughts on this story and other stories covered on Stateside. Easy to connect with us. You can find us online. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on the link that says Stateside. We're on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And, of course, on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Still to come, local leaders all over Michigan are speaking their minds in a new state survey. Just how do they feel about Governor Snyder, state lawmakers, and the overall direction of Michigan? We'll find out in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 2013 has turned into the year America focuses on its farms. That's because the federal farm bill expires at the end of September, and the House and Senate are trying to get a new bill passed. But getting that done has become one of the great legislative challenges of this year, because there are such big differences between the two chambers. For one thing, debate over the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The House and Senate have each passed their versions, and the differences between the two are big. For one thing, the SNAP program has been stripped right out of the House version. Democrats balked, and earlier this week, the House Democratic Caucus sent a letter to Republican Speaker John Boehner urging him to include food stamps in the final version of a House farm bill. So let's take a closer look at the ongoing political saga of this all, which has serious economic implications for Michigan and for the nation. To do so, we welcome Ryan Findley. He's the National Legislative Counsel at the Michigan Farm Bureau. Hello, Ryan.
Good afternoon.
And a professor at the Michigan State University Department of Agricultural, Food, and Resource Economics. We are glad to have back onto the program David Schweikert.
Thank you.
Ryan, I want to start with you, if I might. There are clearly issues causing major disagreement between the House and between the Senate. Can you tell us which are causing the greatest division? Do they run along party lines?
Well, I think you're asking the right question right at the beginning, and that's what is the underlying problem here?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody has that answer. I think some people are going to point to what you just alluded to, the difference in food stamp funding. Everyone refers to it as food stamps when we're sitting around talking, but it is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. What's important to note is that that SNAP program makes up around 80% of the entire farm bill. So when we're talking about the farm bill, there's a lot of discussion on the agricultural component, but a majority of the funding is really for the food stamp or the SNAP program. When we look at farmers, when we look at the agricultural programs that are in there, we can talk about the conservation programs, we can talk about crop insurance, we can talk about commodity programs typically for the corn, soybean, wheat growers in Michigan, including the dairy industry.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at the differences between the House and Senate versions on those programs, they become much, much more minor. It's a subtle difference between the two.
Something that could be ironed out in committee and moved forward.
Yes.
So the big stumbling point is SNAP.
I think that's what a lot of people would say. Now, you're going to have some that would say, well, we need to cut more from the agricultural programs that are out there, and they voted against the bill because enough wasn't cut from the agricultural programs. But there's both sides to this, so it's a challenge. I think from a farmer perspective, farmers are going to say, hey, the bills are pretty close. There's some differences that could be ironed out pretty quick. From a legislator conversation, it's going to evolve more into, well, where do we save money? And if we need to save money, what program do you cut? Some people want to cut ag. Some people want to cut food stamps, and you have a disagreement there.
David Swikert, food assistance has been attached to the farm bills since, what, about the 1970s?
Yes, 1970 and then 73 farm bills for the first two that really created this farm program food stamp coalition, if you will.
And why did that happen in the first place?
Well, it happened for a very pragmatic reason. I think it's a reason that some people still do not agree with, and I can understand that, but it was a very practical political reason. In 1973, the Agriculture Committee looked around. It looked at a changing American society with a shrinking farm population and an increased percentage of people in urban and suburban areas, and it had to confront the blunt reality that they could not pass a farm bill that had only farm subsidies in it. The rest of society was asking, what's in it for me?
Hmm.
What's in it for my district? What's in it for my constituents? And the Ag Committee made the judgment at that time, rightly or wrongly, that they were going to put the two together and build a coalition around that basis. I guess I would put it very bluntly, if our fathers and grandfathers believed that they could not pass a farm-only farm bill in 1973, 40 years ago, I have no idea what makes us think that we're so smart that we know how to do it today.
So here we have the situation. Is there any upside at all to having two separate bills?
Well, it depends on what your initial objectives are. Is there any upside if your objective is to end farm programs and your objective is to end nutrition programs? There's not a better way on this earth you could accomplish that goal than to have two separate bills, because that's what the outcome will be. In fact, there have been many people in the last 20 years, many members of Congress, who want to end those programs, who have advocated exactly that strategy. And now it appears that we have accidentally stumbled into that strategy.
Hmm.
So if that's my objective, that's a pretty good way to accomplish it. Other than that, I'm not sure that there would be any reason for anyone to think there's an upside to that approach. Maybe Ryan disagrees, but I don't see what it would be.
No, I think that from an agricultural perspective, there's a lot of people that say when you have a farm bill, and it's important to know that the farm bill isn't just agriculture and it's not just food stamps, but we have a whole bunch of other programs in there. There's a lot of rural development programs, a lot of grants that go to rural communities so that they can work on infrastructure projects. We have energy programs that are in the farm bill. The farm bill is a lot more than what everybody thinks it is, my perception is that people view it just as agriculture, and it goes way beyond that.
Is that a failure somehow of the farm lobby or backers of the bill to let us know all the other elements involved?
I don't think so. I think it's just the reality that people are used to calling it the farm bill, because that is the primary farm policy that impacts agriculture today.
Let me add one other thing, and I agree with Ryan completely. I think we call it the farm bill today mainly because it's a tradition and it's simple language and easy to use. Let's go a little bit further. We had the Farm Bill Food Stamp the Farm Program Food Stamp Coalition in 1973. Well, what happened next? Well, in the late 70s, and then especially in the 85 Farm Bill, suddenly environmental and conservation programs became a much bigger part of the coalition. Why did that happen? That happened because society changed and society's preferences changed and society's demand for things like environmental quality changed. And right, again, I'm not going to defend this as good or bad policy, but simply reality.
Mm-hmm.
We made the decision that we wanted society to bear part of the cost of dealing with those environmental issues and not leave it to farmers alone to have to pay those costs. So we added environmental and conservation programs over time. We added rural development programs over time. We added program after program over time because the world kept getting more complicated. It wasn't 1933 anymore. It wasn't even 1973 anymore. And as the world got more complicated, we kept adding new policy tools to the mix, i.e. more things in the Farm Bill, because we had more policy targets.
Hmm.
If your only target in policy is to raise farm income, I can write you a really simple one-page bill that will do that for you. But if your policy includes farmer income, environmental quality, consumer prices, the diets of low-income people, all of a sudden I have multiple targets. I can no more hit multiple targets with one simple tool than I can hit five birds with one stone. And so this, what we've seen here is this growth in the number of policy targets, and it requires additional policy tools, and that means that you have more programs in there than just farm programs like we did before 73. And that's not agriculture's fault. And I realize that, yeah, we do put a lot of burden on farm groups to try to explain all this and justify this to society. But again, that's in a sense not their responsibility either. We're asking them to do what we ought to be doing as citizens in understanding why the world is the way it is.
So what happens, do you think, if we've certainly seen a lot of problem on Capitol Hill, the dysfunction of Capitol Hill where things don't get done? So let's say they can't work out these differences in committee and the clock keeps ticking and both the SNAP and the Farm Bill expire in September. Then what?
Well, I'll go first on that one. I think we're really in a no man's land here. We're in getting back into uncharted territory. And by that, I mean I don't think that there's any enthusiasm for an extension, another extension like we had this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you can pass an extension on the floor of the House or the Senate. That would be temporary in nature, so I don't think that's going to work. I would argue the only reason we got an extension this year is it was tied to the fiscal cliff deal in December of 2012. In other words, it was the Farm Bill extension was the small guy riding along on the big package of the fiscal cliff deal. If you don't have a fiscal cliff crisis this year, and hopefully we won't, then how is the Farm Bill going to tag along for an extension? I don't see that there's any enthusiasm for an extension. I don't see any way that there's something big coming along that the Farm Bill can ride along for an extension. I think we are in some real no man's land here from here to the end of the year on what we will do next. We either go to conference or we're stuck.
And what's the view from the Michigan Farm Bureau, Ryan Findley?
I think Dr. Schweikart's right with a lot of what he's saying. I think let's go back a little bit and I was afraid you were going to go with the dysfunction of Congress, and I was going to say that's probably not something that we want to talk about
sure.
on this show, but let's talk about the benefit of putting the Farm Bill together. So Dr. Schweikart just mentioned several different programs, whether they're conservation or some of the nutrition programs. Agriculture has changed a lot in the last 100 years. I think people would say that a lot of programs, not just in agriculture, but society has changed a lot in the last 50 years. One of the benefits of tying all these programs together and asking Congress to review it every 5 years is that they can make changes as programs evolve, as conservation practices evolve, as agricultural practices evolve. We have a chance to look at this package of bills and say, is this the right direction or do we need to reform it? So that's the incentive of encouraging Congress to continually look at this every 5-6 years to make sure that the programs they have in place are appropriate. When you break it up, a couple of things happen. You don't have the chance at review. You may not even bring it up. You may lose some programs that are very beneficial because they just won't make it to the docket for Congress. And so there's a lot of challenges to not including all of this together. But that is a challenge that's facing this Congress, is what do you do now? If we let the Farm Bill expire September 30th of 2013, what happens? And I think that's a question that a lot of people in Congress are asking right now. And the answer is not a lot for the first month or so. But come December 31st of 2013, that's when the permanent law kicks in for some programs such as dairy. And we heard the conversation a year ago on dairy prices going through the roof. Well, the program that would be in place that we would revert to would cause that again. And so if Congress has three options. They can pass an extension, they can pass a new bill, or they can let it expire. And if they let it expire, we're going to run into problems. I don't think the votes are there for an extension. The best option right now is to pass a bill that comes out of conference that both chambers can agree with. I think that's the best decision, but it's probably one of the most challenging.
The people listening to our conversation who perhaps didn't realize how much the Farm Bill impacts their day-to-day life, what should we all be watching for as this summer progresses? Dr. Schweiker, I'll start with you with that.
Well, I guess I've come to the conclusion what we're seeing here is a much broader issue of the use of the conference process as a last-ditch attempt to block what you do not want. And so I think it'll be a real clear sign that we're going to move ahead if there is a conference committee appointed very quickly, and if there's not, we're going to find out what the no man's land really looks like. There's not going to be a bill passed.
And Ryan, what's it look like at the Michigan Farm Bureau? What are you watching?
I think it's time to start looking for a church and start praying. I think that there's a lot of farmers that are frustrated right now over Congress and the fact that we can't get the Farm Bill passed. Look, we go back, and the Farm Bill is typically bipartisan. Both sides of the aisle agree on this. If anything, we have regional differences that tend to flare up during the Farm Bill, but it's always bipartisan. And I think a lot of farmers are frustrated that we don't have a Farm Bill right now and that it has become a partisan issue. We've been working on this bill since 2011, when the super committee met to try and figure out the solution to the fiscal crisis in the fall of 2011. There was a proposal for the Farm Bill that would have taken care of this, and that didn't go anywhere. The super committee failed to act. And in 2012, the summer of 2012, we had a bill passed the Senate, we had a bill passed the House Ag Committee, but we couldn't get it to the floor. And so now 2013 comes around, and we're staring September 30th in the face again, and we still don't have a bill. And it's moved through each chamber, and we're waiting for the conference committee. And that will be important for everybody, but farmers are frustrated right now, bottom line. And there's a lot of hope in the countryside, despite the frustration. There's a lot of hope and optimism. Farmers are naturally optimistic, and they're optimistic this year that Congress can come together, put their differences aside, and pass a Farm Bill.
That was Ryan Findley. He is the National Legislative Counsel at the Michigan Farm Bureau. And we've also been speaking with Professor David Schweikart, who's with the Michigan State University Department of Agricultural, Food, and Resource Economics. We want to thank both of you for bringing your expertise to this very, very complicated issue for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Quickly, an update for you now on a story we've covered many times here on Stateside, transportation funding. We have learned Governor Snyder and legislative leaders are quietly discussing a comprehensive deal to boost spending on road maintenance and education with a sales tax increase. But putting a question to voters soon remains a long shot. The state Senate's top Democrat, Gretchen Whitmer, told reporters it's, in her words, very, very unlikely that lawmakers will act in time to get a constitutional amendment on the November ballot. Raising the 6% sales tax requires 2/3 of lawmakers to vote yes, and then a vote of the people. Talks on ways to boost transportation spending hit a standstill months ago as lawmakers have mainly been focused on whether to expand Medicaid health insurance to more low-income adults. Governor Snyder, of course, has been pushing for more than $1 billion in additional road funding. Still to come, the city of Dearborn is moving toward changing its rules on garage use. But some residents, including people in the city's large Arab community, say the ordinance discriminates against them. We'll find out more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. When it comes to performance reviews for politicians, the big one is the one they face at the ballot box. For Governor Rick Snyder and state lawmakers, that review comes up on November 2014. In the interim, though, the latest Michigan Public Policy Survey can give us something to chew on. This one looks at how local officials view the job Governor Snyder and state lawmakers are doing. The survey is done by the team at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Tom Ivacco is with the Ford School's Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. Welcome back to the program, Tom.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're joining us from Benzie County in northern Michigan. I can't blame you. We're all jealous. But let's talk a little about this survey of local leaders all across Michigan. And just remind us again exactly who's being addressed and who's talking in this survey.
These are local government leaders all across the state from all types of local government, so counties, cities, townships, and villages. So it's a city mayor, a county administrator, a township supervisor, village president, and so on.
So these are the folks in the trenches, if you will. How do they feel about the overall direction of the state?
Well, overall, 54% think that Michigan is moving in the right direction. That's up very slightly from a year ago when 50% said that they thought the state was generally heading in the right direction. So we've seen a little bit of improvement in the last year among local leaders.
Is that maybe less improvement than you might have expected, or was it on track for what you were expecting?
Well, you know, actually, we went into this survey not quite knowing what to expect. There were a lot of significant policy developments in Lansing this year that affect local government, and we weren't sure how local leaders would feel about those. And at the same time, Michigan's economy, you know, had been improving pretty significantly. It seems to have kind of eased back a little bit, but it's still better than it was a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot of factors involved in how local leaders may think Michigan is doing well or not. And we honestly didn't know what to expect. So I guess, you know, a marginal improvement seems about right.
Do we have an idea why that 54% thinks Michigan is headed in the right direction?
Well, we have to do kind of a stepwise analysis here. What we have learned in doing these surveys is one of the most important factors in these views is the partisanship of Michigan's local leaders, whether they are Republican, independent, or Democrat. And at the same time, their views on whether the state is heading in the right direction are also strongly impacted by their views of the job performance of state policymakers in Lansing.
Mm-hmm.
So on the partisanship end, it's pretty straightforward. Local Republican leaders overwhelmingly think the state's heading in the right direction. 69% feel that way. Only 43% of independent local leaders feel that way. And just a quarter, 26% of local Democratic leaders think we're heading in the right direction. So partisanship plays a big role in these views.
Well, let's move into overall, does this majority feeling that the state's headed in the right direction, does that translate into a majority thumbs up for Governor Rick Snyder?
Well, it does, just barely. 51% of Michigan's local leaders think Governor Snyder is doing either an excellent job or a good job. So it's a very slight majority. It's up 2 percentage points from last year when 49% felt that way. But again, these are strongly influenced by the partisanship of local leaders. So two-thirds of Republicans think the governor is doing a good or an excellent job. Again, 43% of independents and just 19% of Democrats at the local level think the governor is doing a good job overall.
And how about what did they not like? Let me ask you that first before we talk about state lawmakers. What did they not like about what's happening in the governor's office?
We got over 1,700 descriptions of what they're thinking about. And there's a lot of different factors going on in the minds of local leaders. Among those who think he's doing a good or an excellent job, the most common thing they talk about is that he gets things done. He's taking tough decisions and not, you know, hemming and hawing. He's getting things done. They also believe that his business background and the way that he is running state government like a business is good. They think he's fiscally responsible. People who think he's doing a good job believe he doesn't play politics, that he's pretty straightforward. And they think he's moving Michigan in the right economic direction. On the other hand, those who think he's doing a poor job, the most common comment is they think he's not straightforward, that he may have had a hidden agenda. They also dislike his tax policies, thinking it's tilted too heavily towards businesses and away from especially lower and middle class citizens. They think he's maybe a little too close to business and too difficult on labor. They think he's been he's cut funding for local government too much, and he's moving Michigan in the wrong economic direction. So people on both sides of these common issues see the governor in different ways.
Very different ways. I'm speaking with Tom Evacco with the Ford Center School for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan, looking at their latest survey of local leaders, the Michigan Public Policy Survey, looking at what their thoughts are on the performance of our governor, our state lawmakers, and whether Michigan is on the right track. So on to the state legislature, how'd they fare at in the opinion of our local leaders?
Well, significantly worse than Governor Snyder, and there's a pattern here that this is similar to findings from previous years. Overall, only 26% of local leaders think that the state legislature is doing a good or an excellent job, and that's fairly similar to last year. So views on the legislature's performance are significantly worse than views on the governor's performance.
Hmm. Is there a breakdown in party lines, or are there lots of Republicans who aren't happy with the GOP-led legislature?
There are, again, breakdowns along party lines, but the differences are not as significant as for the governor. Overall, only 37% of Republican local leaders give a thumbs up to the state legislature. 16% of independents, just 6% of Democrats. So there's definitely a difference by partisan ID, but among local Republicans, again, 37% say the legislature is doing a good job, whereas 66% thought Governor Snyder's doing a good job.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing when you look. That's like more than 60% of the Republicans who didn't sign up to say, yes, they're doing a good job.
That's right. Yeah, so a lot of dissatisfaction at the local level among local leaders of all stripes.
Is it because of what happened in lame duck? Are we hearing reasons why?
Well, again, we asked why, and we got 1,300 descriptions from local leaders in their views about the job by the legislature. Among those who think it's doing a good job, fairly similar to what they think about Governor Snyder, the most common thing they say is that the legislature is taking on tough issues and getting things done. Those who think it's doing a good job, think it's pretty straightforward. It works well together and with the governor. It's transparent. They think the legislature is heading Michigan in the right economic direction, and they think it has been fiscally responsible and has done a good job producing balanced budget. On the other hand, those who think it's doing a poor job, the most common thing they cite are its politics, saying that the legislature is simply too partisan and won't compromise. They ram legislation through. I think that in particular reflects the lame duck session last fall.
Mm-hmm.
They also dislike revenue sharing cuts. And similar to the governor, they think legislature is taking us in the wrong economic direction and has bad tax policies.
In the time that you've been doing these surveys, Tom, do you see these views of local leaders working their way into the mindset of the voting public? I guess I'm asking, could we see these kinds of attitudes being shown at the voting places a year from November?
That's an interesting question, and I think our surveys are still so new. This is the fifth year that we've been doing these, so there's only been one statewide election so far since we've been doing these for governor, at least. So I'm not sure how we think these may be filtering down. I think what is safe to assume is the partisan breakdown is going to be the same in the general public as we found among local leaders. I think there's likely to be the same kind of thing going on where folks who think the legislature is doing a good job, you know, and the governor will base it on a variety of things, tax policy, focusing on cutting regulations and helping business. A lot of folks probably will support the right to work legislation. And on the other side, a lot of folks will be upset about all those kind of things. So just like with local leaders, I think the general public in the state will be divided over the same topics with views on each side.
Tom Avaca was with the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks for talking with us, Tom. Always good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
Well, there have been some developments in the debate over garages in the city of Dearborn. You may recall some folks in Dearborn have been using their garages as gathering spaces, some of them equipped with sliding glass doors, couches, refrigerators, water pipes, TVs. This has been especially popular with Dearborn's large Arab community. This week, the Dearborn Planning Commission approved changes in rules that govern the way Dearbornites may use their garages. And there are those in the Arab community who feel that these rules changes are a direct slap at them. Jeff Karub has been covering this debate for the Associated Press. And Jeff joins us now from Detroit. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Cindy.
Well, before you explain to us just what the Planning Commission wants to do with the garage use rules, recap for us just what the objections and problems were with people putting in those glass doors and hanging out with family and friends in their garages.
Well, it actually was the installation of sliding glass doors by a few residents that caught the city's attention. People have known for a long time that many Arab Americans, and others for that matter, do gather in their garages, but it is a social custom among Arab Americans to gather with friends, with family, drink some coffee, perhaps smoke a hookah pipe, and it's something that's happened for a very long time. But some people decided that the space needed some protection from the elements, some protection from weather, protection from insects and so forth.
Fair enough.
And so they installed some sliding glass doors, and the city took notice at that point, and they decided they needed to beef up or clarify, depending on your perspective, the ordinances around using garages.
So the Planning Commission got together this week, and what changes did they come up with?
Well, they decided that the city needed to clarify its garage use rules. The city said that this is not about restrictions. It's actually allowing more uses for the garage. But at one time, or actually right now, the rules only allow for parking of vehicles and incidental household storage. So they decided they need to clarify what the garage can be used for. And so the Planning Commission unanimously approved some changes on Monday. It now needs to go to the full city council for final approval, which could come as early as next month.
So I'm trying to figure this out. Is this as if the commission is trying to split the difference, as in, okay, you can use your garages for occasional parties or hobbies or socializing, but no sliding glass doors? Isn't that going to leave pretty much everyone unhappy?
Well, it also depends on how some of these new rules, should they be enacted, how they'll be interpreted. The city's ordinance, the proposed ordinance, the one that they hope to enact here in the next several weeks, says no garage shall be converted into habitable space. Living space shall be defined as space within a structure for living, sleeping, eating, or cooking. It also prohibits building sliding glass doors or using sliding glass doors as an enclosure. Hmm. They want the traditional retractable garage door to be the way to enclose your garage. But what will be interesting to see how residents react to is language that says occasional use of a garage for social gatherings, such as parties, which doesn't involve a physical conversion or renovation of the garage, is permitted. So I think one question on a lot of people's minds will be, what does occasional mean? What if we do it every day?
Yeah.
And it's for an hour a day. Is that occasional? So that question could come up.
Were there objections filed by neighbors who weren't interested in seeing through the glass doors into other people's garages?
Well, there are neighbors who I know in one case I've talked to a couple of people who have the sliding glass doors, and I talked to some of the neighbors of people who have sliding glass doors. There are some people who say you should keep your garage, you should have garage doors that are not transparent. Hmm. But other people, for instance, in the neighborhood where two of these glass doors have been installed, say, we are not trying to close ourselves off to the world. We're trying to open ourselves up to the world. And neighbors in that neighborhood had no problem with the sliding glass doors, at least some I talked to.
You know, as I thought about this story, Jeff, and I get the feeling this is not just something within the Arab community. And I'll tell you why. My husband is from Ireland. His brother has an attached garage that he has put that sliding door in. He has an office. There is a bathroom in there. And no problem at all. My landlady, when I went to school in Ireland, actually had converted that into sleeping space. So I get the feeling that there's parts of the world that looks at a garage totally different than the folks who are running Dearborn.
I think Dearborn wants, if I'm speaking for a moment as a Dearborn city official, they're saying that we're trying to take everything into account. We're trying to address safety issues. They're trying to protect what they call the integrity of neighborhoods, ease parking congestion, and at the same time say to a resident, if you want to use your garage for some entertaining, for some social gathering, you can, but you can't convert it because then you're going to need a building permit and the garage is being used for something that the rest of the house should be used for. So I think that it could raise some problems, and it certainly isn't only Arab Americans who use their garage. It might be for home brewing of beer, for instance. Mm-hmm. It might be for the ratty old couch that used to be in the living room that's now in the garage, and they can watch the Michigan game or the Michigan State game or the Lions game. This happens throughout Dearborn among people from all backgrounds, and I know it happens in communities across the state, the country, and even beyond the country, as you suggest.
Yes.
So the enforceability will be a key. I think the interpretation of this ordinance, should it pass, will be key.
And I just think about the folks that I've seen quoted from the Arab community who say, well, show me what is so illegal about sitting on the couch with my friends in my garage, drinking coffee and maybe watching TV.
There's one gentleman by the name of Muhib Nabulsi, and he's fairly incensed by it. He believes that his rights are being infringed. He has the sliding glass door in front of the traditional electronic garage door.
Okay.
He says, this is what, I don't use this to live. I don't sleep in here. I don't cook in here. Well, he has essentially a patio in his garage. He showed the city that he could drive over the track and get into his garage if need be. He has no intention of parking in his garage. He says he could if he needed to. For him, it comes down to, I am not doing anything illegal. He will have to take that up with the city. He has a court date coming because he was cited for installing the sliding glass door. I don't know how the new ordinance, should it pass, will affect that, but he is one of a group of people who believe that what they do in their garage should be allowed if nothing illegal is going on.
And if this Planning Commission's suggested changes do become city ordinance, do you get the sense this could become a civil liberties case, Jeff?
Well, I never like to predict these things. Certainly the ACLU or some other body could take this up. I think there will be question around some of the language, like I suggested before, what is occasional use of garages for social gatherings and things like that. I wouldn't want to get into the prediction game, but I could see residents like Mr. Nabulsi taking this further.
Jeff Karub is with the Associated Press, and he spoke to us today from their offices in Detroit. Jeff, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Cindy.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered today by Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and April Van Buren. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.